Welcome back to Labeled, the stories, rumors, and legends of Tooth & Nail Records. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today we've got Ryan Kirby from Fit for a King, who's one of the most successful bands in the modern era of Solid State Records, originally signing in 2012. They've worked really hard to build the band's following in both the physical and digital realms, and they come from a long history of shared values and sounds of Solid State bands. And they've integrated really well into the larger metalcore scene and continue to build a presence in the even wider digital landscape of metal in the general mainstream whole way. Ryan Kirby is the lead vocalist, he's the lyric writer, and he co-manages the band. I think you'll find this conversation to be illuminating and give perspective into his mindset and why it all works so well. All right, here we go. Where are you, Fillmore?
Yeah, Fillmore, Denver. It's the second night here, so at least our vehicle was still all night.
That's great. And you're in a bandwagon, is that right?
Yeah.
Nice, nice. And so you guys drive it?
We have a driver.
You have a driver for it, but bandwagon in between a van and a bus kind of a thing. But if you have a driver, that's it.
Yeah, we hire, like, he could be driving a bus, but we pay him well to drive the bandwagon because better safe than sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that you saw the Silent Planet guys and their predicament there and their accident. And how, I mean, that's, they're not on your tour, but they're somehow intersecting. They were headed west on I-80. Is that right?
Yeah. We were going east on I-80.
And you were going east on I-80 from Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone that's toured knows that's a horrible drive anytime from like October to honestly April.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know you've probably done that a bunch of times, but you know, there's no band I know that hasn't, that when you bring up I-80 between Salt Lake and Denver, won't tell you of what happened to them on that road. And there's you know, all the way from Bayside, you know, having somebody in their band die, and you know, the drummer for Bayside died in that on that corridor, and that was 2003 or four or something like that. But I've been on tours before where bands crash, miss the shows. We've spun out there. It's the craziest road in the world because it's just, it
the
looks,
wind and the ice. It's flat too.
Yeah, it's flat, but you can just be going down and you just slide off. I mean, and it could be black ice, and the storms can come crazy, and they can come for 5 months a year, and there's no other way to navigate the country than to really make that drive. So it's almost unavoidable. You have to roll the dice.
It's, and it's honestly between, it's a routing where you almost have to, if you play Salt Lake, you, like you said, you have to go to Denver, but you also can't, some people be like, skip Salt Lake. And it's like, but Salt Lake A is a great place to play. And B, it kind of links the Pacific Northwest down to the rest of the country. Unless you just want to drive straight down California, but why would you want to miss out on good spots like Boise and Salt Lake City?
You can go across I-90 and skip all that and like go to Chicago from Seattle if you want to, but it's not like they don't. And if all bands did that, there would probably be a lot of accidents you would hear about on that. So because they have the same problem, it's just they don't have the shows don't route that way. Exactly. Yeah,
I think that's what people don't think about that don't tour is the weather, because we have a headliner in February, March, and in the back of my head, I'm like, oh my God, the weather's going to be rough. Because I see Salt Lake, Denver on that, and it'll be like in February. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, we'll roll the dice again, like you said. And people just think about the band. Like, I went to the show, the band played cool. It's like, but all the stuff getting to the shows in the winter is the part that's not too fun.
Yeah, and the Northeast can be bad too, especially if you go in like between Pittsburgh, like all those roads can be really crazy. In the,
and they get windy.
They're super windy, yeah, exactly. So it's treacherous no matter what, and I hope Silent Planet and everything's okay. It seems like their GoFundMe went well and everything. I'm glad everybody's okay. So at least, you know, that's the most sympathetic. You set a picture of an upside-down van in the snow. That's a pretty good lead for support.
What's also interesting about the wreck, which I'm happy nobody got severely hurt, because it's like you can openly talk about the situation without there being this dark cloud lifted, because their GoFundMe was funded, everybody's good. That was actually our van that we sold to them 2 years ago.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and so it took care of them whenever it flipped.
Wow, that's weird karma in that. So it's like you're in the bandwagon with the driver, but your van flipped on the road you were on the same night.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really cool. I had no idea. So you had that van and had toured in it a long time. Like, tell me the story of that van. I love stories of vehicles. Yeah. I don't know why.
That van we bought in 2017, and it was like a Ford Sprinter van. It did well for us. We drove it. Honestly, 2017 sounds like a long time ago, but two of the years didn't do anything because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So we drove it for probably a good 2 years. The van before that, though, had some real stories. We bought it in like 08. Wow. It was a Chevy Express, like most people had. Put some bunks in it, a futon mattress, made it home like most vans. And we did 3 Warp Tours in that van.
Wow, that's got stories and history. What happened to it?
It started dying. Like, it was, I think it was the 3rd Warp Tour. We had to dump like $15,000 for repairs into it, and it just still wasn't getting. It's like one thing after the other. The transmission got repaired, broke, replaced, broke. It got up to 400,000 miles.
No way. That's great. That's so huge. That's huge.
I was like, we got our money's worth. We bought for $15,000 in 2008, which was pricey for a local van. But when it lasts you almost 10 years and 3 Warped Tours, you're just like, well, we got our money's worth.
Wow. So you really did all the miles. You probably put 300 plus of those miles on it, right?
Yeah. It was bought with like 30,000.
Nice. That's incredible. I love to measure the amount of miles you've done, you know, on the road. And when you have a single vehicle, it's easy to track. And then when you rent and then do buses or bandwagons,
stop losing track. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be nice to just have to know how many miles I have traveled on interstates. I can make an estimate, but it's nice having it all in one vehicle. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We had our first van had 3 something on it, and it died right outside of Denver. So another link in that story there. Got a picture of it. It was on the way into Denver from Kansas, but like halfway into Denver, and it just,
all those mountains.
The transmission bled out, and it was like we left it in this parking lot, and you could see the transmission fluid. And we have a picture of it. It's really sad. It's because that's the van where every single thing happened, you know, for so many years. And we had somebody come tow it, and then they were like, they could fix it and sell it or whatever. And I just never called the guy back, so it just is there somewhere. So they claimed it, did whatever with it, but yeah. You know, it's nearby Denver as we speak, so that's something.
Our van's death wasn't as graceful. We had to leave it in LA at the LA Warped, because it was just every time we'd get on any kind of mountain, because getting into LA over the mountains, and anytime it was, say, transmission overheating, it was freaking out. So we got there, and we still had three more California shows, which is all mountain, like going from LA up to Mountain View. So we rented just like any van we could get for the last 3 days, because we're like, we can't miss. So we left our van at an AMCO because we were told we had warranty. Apparently it was voided, because one of the days at Warped, we went to an AMCO and we're like, can you fix it? It's having issues. And they're just like, no, it'll take 4 days. And we're like, well, we can't miss 4 days of the tour. That's a lot of money. And they're just like, well, if you leave here, we're voiding your warranty, because I told you that you shouldn't be driving it. So I guess we left it in an AMCO for the 3 days, which they wanted to charge us. And we ended up getting back after the 3 days when the tour ended, because we were just going to drive it back to Texas and just do whatever we could. And somebody left a bunch of Taco Bell in the van. And there were millions of ants. It was like the whole van was just covered in ants. So we went to a car wash and vacuumed out ants.
Oh, wow.
For like 2 hours. And then we had to sleep in this. So we're hoping we didn't miss any of the ants, which we did, of course. Because they were like in the crevices of... So we were riding back from California to Texas in an ant-infested van that had transmission issues, and we would have to let it sit for a few hours, keep driving, let it sit. And then after about 8 hours into the drive, the AC stopped working. And this is the summer, because it's Warped Tour. So we're driving through Arizona, New Mexico, with no AC, and it finally gets to Texas, and it's literally like you can tell the engine's just dying. It crawls up to my house, and then I have somebody come and tow it, and we get $500 for it. Because I was just like, this was after $15,000 of work, and it had ants all in it. And I was just like, I'm sorry, we can't. So we all took a picture with it. Some of the guys have tattoos of the van with like an RIP, and it'll say like 08 to 2017.
Wow. So, and then you got the Sprinter from there. It had 2 years, and now that one's gone, and you're up to a bandwagon. Have you ever done a tour bus? You haven't done a bus yet?
No, we definitely like, I've gotten quotes and stuff, but I've always said we need to earn it. Like our next headliner, I was like, if we do extremely well on this next headliner, like expectations will be a tour bus van. Mm-hmm. And I always told myself too, we have to hit a threshold of guarantee, which we're technically there, but I was like this tour we're doing, we're a support band. We don't even have production. And I was like, let's just take a bandwagon. Like we don't need to be in a bus. We can do more hotels or something like that.
Well, you're in a lineage of bands that have had different opinions and stuff about business and buses and stuff like that. But the bands that you remind me of in the way that you do your business are these bands that are very good at that delayed gratification thing and taking it seriously and doing making smart business decisions. And, you know, August Burns Red is one of those bands who they were just in a van so long and just taking home so much money. And they were the first band to really get that big and stay in a van. Not the first band, but I'm just saying it was really impressive the way that they were focused in that way with their values. And something about that reminds me, you know, of you guys too.
I think a lot of that has to do with, we toured with them a lot earlier in our career. And we got to talk with them a lot. And I think because our first tour with ABR was in 2015. And then we did Warped in a van in 2014, but we were on the Ernie Ball stage making like $300 a day. So you're not going to get a tour bus or a bandwagon making that. And then we played Monster Stage 2015. And this was after ABR. We could have gotten a bandwagon, but we would have legit gone home with $0. No, it was like an $800 a day. And then we got to 2017 and we're like, still weren't getting paid that much more. It's $1,200 a day, which sounds a lot to a lot of people. But, you know, you're splitting it with a bunch of crew and everyone in your band and all that. And it was still one of those things like, we could do a bandwagon, but we won't make any money. And we were just like, let's do the van one more time. And we made a lot of money, even though we had to pay $15,000 for repairs on the van through the tour. But I think it was a big hit, and it actually earned us a lot of respect with a lot of bands on the tour. They're like, you're the band that's on Monster Stage with those big crowds and you're in a van.
Yeah.
And then they're like, why are you doing that? I was like, I'd rather live well at home. I was like, I'm taken care of on tour. You guys got catering every day. There's all this stuff. It's like, at home, I need money. I'm married. I have a wife, and I don't want to come home with nothing and then be like scavenging together things on the house. It's like, I could do that a lot easier on tour because, you know, there's catering and there's all that stuff on the road.
Ryan, can I try a slightly different thing with your microphone? Are you using AirPods right now, right?
Yeah.
Could you try switching the microphone to the built-in mic?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a glitch in there that might be better the other way. If not, we'll switch back.
All right. How does this sound?
Way better. Sorry to everybody that didn't switch that earlier.
Oh, I can hear you.
Okay. That's going to do better. Sorry for the glitch.
All good. I know the MacBook listeners mics there, but are a lot better.
We're on the right track now. And to that point, yeah, it's a great thing to really had to do that hard work and stuff. I was looking at bus quotes recently, and I mean, you know, there's a headline and tour now. There's stuff like $93,000 all in for a headliner tour is like the numbers I've seen, you know, recently. So,
which I guess, to give people perspective, we just got our bandwagon quote for our headliner, and it's like $30,000.
Mm-hmm. A big difference.
It's there. Yeah.
So this theme is really cool that you are such a successful band and able to really bring home money, have a real career, take care of yourselves at home, you know, to be where you are there is just quite an accomplishment. And you had to pay the dues to get there, and you have the long history, and come from a culture like that and everything. So I find all that really, really fascinating. But that, is that the case? You guys are, do you think of yourselves as DIY, like in running the business at all aspects? You're very hands-on. Can you tell me about your configuration there?
I guess we're about as DIY as you can get with like being on a label. That's what I mean, we have booking agents, or a booking agent, but we have a manager, but I kind of co-manage the band with him. He's the guy who goes out and pitches us for stuff and gets stuff done. If somebody needs to be yelled at, he goes and does it. We've always been like, there shouldn't be someone in the band doing the like yelling at anyone, because you don't want it to negatively impact the like image of your band with how you speak to people in the industry. Whereas our manager, he can go in on someone if they're like late on getting a shipment to us or whatever. But I do like all of our financials. I take care of our taxes. I obviously work with like a bookkeeping tax company, but I'm the one who like goes over things with them. While our other manager, he worries about the merch orders, getting all that, basically stuff I don't want to do or I shouldn't do, like we were talking about before. He takes care of that, and then I take care of the rest of the stuff. And then we pretty much can, I trust our manager too with like a lot of artistic stuff as far as like merchandise goes. He's really good with merchandise. He's also Silent Planet's guy, and he does a lot of their merchandise. And Silent Planet has great merch.
August Burns Red really is one of the best managed self-management stories of really anybody. So that is really cool. The early exposure you had, you know, to them in that way, but they were, have been helpful to you personally.
Yeah. Just getting advice from them. And honestly, like, I think a big influence for how much I do with our band was, first we toured with Four Today in 2014. Actually, it's a three. Now I think about it. In 2013, we toured with Attila, which I know a lot of people be like, Attila. But in 2013, their band was crushing like that. That was our first like big tour. And they, every day was sold out pre-sale. It was like a crazy tour. And Franz, he's actually, he's really friendly. And he runs their entire band. Like he was, so getting to talk to him, it was a guy who was very hands-on with everything his band does. And then our next tour was with Four Today, very contrasting tours. But Ryan LaTrue with Four Today is extremely hands-on with all of Four Today's financials and everything they do. And then in 2015, we toured with August Burns Red, which we know JB, Brent, very hands-on with all the financials and everything at EBR does. So I was kind of like thrown into the touring world, playing with all these people that were extremely hands-on, very involved. And if they didn't control everything, they controlled most of everything to do with their band. And I think getting to talk with them and get advice from all of them really like helped mold how I treated the band and how we treated the band. And it's like, I think it's something a lot of bands need to do more of, because I've talked to a lot of bands that make really good money as far as like money that comes in. And then for some reason, none of them make any money when it comes out. And I'm like, there's got to be. But some of them are like, oh, I don't deal with all that. That's their manager. And I'm like, you should want to, like, you should wonder, where's all this going?
Absolutely. There's a, it's a, it's really beautiful to me that there's a shared culture of like bands that didn't, they were indie way back and didn't know, got taken advantage of, had debt, had bad predatory people and businesses. And then you hear those stories and they get passed around and people become more hands on. And so you can borrow from the people before you and learn from their mistakes. And then, you know, the trend that you're on is a definitely emergent one that's going to continue. And there's bigger bands. I'm not saying any names, but there's bands that just, you know, they come home from a tour and they clean house. They go, that's it. I'm firing all these people once they really get it. You know, that happens. And it's going to continue to happen because there's so many stories of bands that are not, it's not like you can look at these super successful bands and say, yeah, but if they had better management, they'd be what would they be? I mean, they're totally successful. They dictate the terms of their career. So I just love seeing that culture build. Yeah. And you know, I'm a fan. I'm a defender of. I will say that I think Franz is cool too. He is a plenty of bad stuff people could say about Attila, but he leans into that. You know, he's a real guy that really is very hands on. He loves what he does. He comes to our shows if we're playing down the street. He comes over to our show, just sings on walls and stage dives in the crowd. I mean, he's just he loves it. Like, you know, he's a interesting and cool person and a leader. You know, in his own way.
And so, it's like, whether you like him or not, he's a genuine person.
Yeah,
he is who he is.
Yeah. And how about For Today? I don't have a lot of experience with them. I know a lot about them, and they get tons of, you know, stories about them. And I'm going to do something with them on this podcast, eventually. But I just don't have that much direct experience. I'm curious more what is special about that band while we're there.
A lot of it is Ryan LaTrue. He's their guitar player, singer. He pretty much managed the band, RIP. Just gave great advice with financials, and I learned they were making good money. Like, each individual member was going in with good money, and so I was just like, I want to absorb everything he teaches about, like, what vehicles to take on a tour, how to spend your money on production and all that. And honestly, his advice has been great. He still will come out when we play in Oklahoma because he lives up in Tulsa. Now he's just doing production work. I'd say he did almost all the business stuff. Maddie was like the face. Mm-hmm. And then Ryan was the brains behind all of it. Not implying the other ones didn't have brains, but he was the one running the operation.
You usually have that combo, and sometimes it's in one guy, which was more rare, but a lot of times you have two of those. You have Aaron Gillespie and Tim McTague in one band or something like that. They have three with Spencer, but you know what I mean? A lot of times you have that combo. But how were they, what were they like on tour and their show? And Maddie is a legend in his own way. What have you got about, what experience do you have now that what I have you on here about that?
They're just another group of like very genuine people. You know, I might have my disagreements or whatever, especially if it comes to like theology stuff or whatever, but he is genuine about the way he is on stage and everything. And I can appreciate just people being who they are and not being some fake character on stage, unless it's like a gimmick thing. I can appreciate that. If you can like really like the stuff you see a lot, like Ghost and stuff, like I can appreciate that. Because it's so well done. It's just if a person acts super religious on stage and then is a complete like piece of poop. I don't know what the cursing policy is on
whatever
the podcast. But yeah, there's some people that are like super holy on stage and a complete piece of shit off stage. Mm-hmm. Which obviously not going to name names on that. But For Today was not that way at all. And I think what I really learned from them is like what it looks like to have a super dedicated fan base, because their fan base was just ride or die For Today. They love
absolutely, yeah.
And I was like, I want that. And I think that's really what's helped me throughout our musical career pursue real supporters, not just fans, like supporters of the band. And which a lot of stuff like radio and all that doesn't really bring you. It can, but a lot of times it's fleeting. Whereas whatever For Today ABR has, it's like, it's not fleeting. It's their life.
Yeah, not going anywhere. That's right. Yeah. And that's amazing to see. And you guys have some other whole thing going on where there's a couple of different angles here I want to go to try to make sense out of your story, because there's a lot in it. But one more thing from your background that I wanted to ask about that I picked up from the Black Sheep podcast, which I'd love to use for prep for this podcast. I love what they always have the same people on as me, and I like their show. But you mentioned in there something about having really supportive parents. So one of the things that seems common in a lot of the successful bands is having some type of supportive parents. Versus parents you're rebelling against. And also a lot of times there's just these technical minded people are part of the people that do finance or engineering or things like that. And I'm curious how that intersects with you.
My parents were super supportive. They let us practice at the house. They helped us pay for our first recordings when I was 15 years old. And none of that, like, my parents didn't have any history with music or anything. I mean, my dad's an accountant and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And so it was like, they didn't even like metal. To this day, they're still like, oh, I really like your one with the singing. but they were never like shutting it down. And a lot of parents, I've had kids come up to me at shows, just be like, I really want to play music, but my parents think metal is like Satan music, or like, they don't like it. It's too noisy. They don't want it in their house. And I think it's just really sad that people would shut down another person's form of expression just because a guitar is distorted and in a drop tuning. Like, and their vocal delivery is different than something. So I appreciate, looking back, a lot of my parents being super open-minded to me just screaming in my bedroom with my friends playing really bad metal music. Because we all know what 15-year-old metal music can sound like, especially when you're all mad at what you're doing.
Yeah. And also, it's a lot of it is, even if they're not thinking that it's evil, it's that they really don't want that to be what you put your eggs in that basket for, a career instead of college, career track, other stuff. A lot of times that's where it falls apart.
Yeah. And because they're like, there's no money in it. Like, you see all the stereotypes in movies like School of Rock and all of that, where he's like the musician bum at his friend's house who's just like, you got to go get a real job, that whole thing. And my parents definitely were like, you need to go to college and stuff. And then I was in college and I wasn't doing amazing because I was doing music and college. I was still balancing. And then my parents were like, you either need to do the band or school. They're like, because you have to go all in on one or the other. You can't half-ass stuff, because half-assing stuff gets you nowhere.
Right.
And
what were you studying?
Like, but if you're in the band, if you choose the band, you have to, because you either need to be working full-time or you need to be in school full-time to live at our house. And I ended up finding another place to live because I couldn't work full-time with all the band stuff. And so some people are like, well, that's mean. They should have let you live there. But it kept me driven, because I had to make it work myself. If they had just let me stay at their house, lounge around, I don't know if I'd be here. So I really appreciate that they said you should do one or the other, but you got to do this if you're going to do the band.
That sounds wise, instead of just, you know, you can be anybody that has a guitar and likes to play with YouTube, because they leave me alone, mom. I'm going to be a musician one day, and it's in the basement, you know. So that's not necessarily the path.
I had to go move to Oklahoma. I found a guy who was a fan of the band, which is crazy at this time because our band was a local band. And he's like, you can live in one of my rooms, $100 a month for every month that you're here. So whenever I tour, which is huge when you're at that level, because you're not making any money whatsoever. You basically work so you can have money on tour, then spend all that money, then come back home with no money, work. And then it's just like an endless cycle of not ever having money. But I was 21. I didn't have a wife. It was just me. So it's like, I can live poor. And it was honestly my parents that, So 2011 is when I moved to Oklahoma, like a really small town in Oklahoma is where this guy lived. And I started doing flooring and stuff in between tours to make ends meet. And in 2012, we were doing another like DIY tour. This is before we had signed or anything. And we were just got done playing a show to like three people. And I think it was Las Vegas or something. And I was just like, I remember we got a hotel because we were like, we hadn't showered in like a week and a half. And the hotels in Vegas can be really cheap depending on the day of the week. I think it was like $18 for the room. So we were like, all right, let's all scrounge some money together and get a room so we can all shower. And I remember being in the elevator and I just kind of broke down because we just played a show for three people. At the time, I'm 22 years old. Like dating my wife, But, and I'm just like, I can't keep doing this. This is like, this doesn't make sense. Cause I also was overdrafted. My parents put $30 in my account just so it would go up to $5. And that's another thing. My parents are well off, but they're more well off now. They were middle class whenever I was touring. So they could have helped. I never asked for help because I was like, it's my choice to do music. It's not theirs. But I was like, called my mom and I was like, I think I'm going to quit. Like, I was just trying to figure out if I could like do college or something again. Like, can I go live there while I go to college and like get some money saved up? And they are the ones that convinced me to like keep going. They're like,
beautiful.
Keep going. Like, because we put out a music video that hit 1 million views, but that doesn't really matter when you're playing in front of 3 people at a show. And she's just like, just keep doing it. Like, your music video is doing really good. And like, you never know. And then it was like 2 weeks late. Actually, it was a week later is when Solid State called us.
Oh, tell me about that. This is great. I mean, those rock bottom moments, I mean, they're so crystal. Yeah. And everybody has them. Like, you know, everybody has these exact type of moments. And then there's that difference maker of who it is or why you make it through or keep going. And it's usually a combination of things. But that's really cool to hear. How does that work? What is the Solid State connection? How does it happen?
I mean, there had been on and off talks like for a while, but Solid State had never shown. Like, I think Face Down Records at one point reached out, but they said we needed to get rid of the singing for us to sign. So we didn't want to because we like singing. For all the people that get upset when we don't do heavy music, we've liked singing since day one. But we were like, no, we want to do singing. And then so we were just kind of like, there's little small labels like Tragic Hero or Standby that would reach out, but we weren't really wanting to, like, at that point, we were at least savvy enough to be like, that's not a career move to go to one of those labels. That's just getting signed to get signed. And then Solid State called, like, sent an email. It was Adam.
Adam.
And he was just like, do you want to get on the phone and chat a little bit? We talked. We still love Adam. We actually just had dinner with him last night. So it's still cool, like a decade later, just going out. We all talked. We got the deal worked out. And even then, after we got signed, because you expect, like, everybody expects, oh, now it's good. Things are great. Still didn't make any money. Because I've also learned booking agents are almost more important than a record label. It was then we did our first week. The first week went really well for it being our first record. Then a booking agent reached out to us. And that's when we started getting like the Attila tour, the Four Today tour, the August Burns Red tour. And that's when things really started to like escalate as far as like awareness for our band. So that even took 7 months after signing just to get that agent. Because before that, we still weren't getting any tours. And we weren't getting, like, we would do a run with those sleeper, play for 100 people a night. And it's like, I was like, well, I'm still not making anything. And I still didn't, honestly, I tell people we didn't even make good money, like above what a part-time McDonald's cashier would make until like our record Dark Skies. So it's like that journey still took another 5 years just to make enough to live.
Yeah. And Dark Skies was 2018.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a long time to brew. There's a bunch of factors there that are interesting, but you're right. The booking agent is the key to getting in front of people because you can have an online audience now at this yeah. time period when you came in, but not a physical audience. And record labels, even when they did make a ton of money in the biggest heyday, not the artists never in those deals even wound up making a lot of money from that.
Oh, our so
it's
deal
always
bad,
been.
Sorry, it's always been. We're still with you guys, but our deal's great now. But it was.
But that's
good.
The way the power balance has always been.
We had nothing to offer.
Well, right, yeah, and so the label is the first person before there's an agent, you know, the agents yeah. and stuff like the bands that are already signed and then start having success. And but you know the physical event space where you can go and be is how you make money. So it is true that the agent is the is
we had
the
nothing
key
to negotiate
that.
With. We're just like, that's right. All the risk is on the label when you first sign.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's really fascinating that I'm trying to get my head around is how much the times change and have changed. Your career one way to say it is it's all there's always been the digital component. So you were like in you started playing in a band when the internet was already a big thing and probably MySpace. It was like MySpace. What were you?
Yeah, we first started. We kind of I joined Fit for a King in 2010. All the local bands before that I was in were all MySpace centered. So when I joined, it was like right at the MySpace to Facebook transition.
Yes, kind of like
a new beginning for the band almost.
And so you could have a YouTube video or get followings there and maybe still not sell tickets or have shows. That's the weird thing is, you know, you could have one and not the other.
Bands with 3 million monthly listeners and then they draw 50 people to a show.
Yeah, it was even more that way now than ever. But that's what now if you zoom from there all the way to here, I kind of want to dig in and talk about, you know, this new force because now it's way more than ever that the you know, back at MySpace and that stuff, it was still like it was digital, but it was still direct and word of mouth, and you would build an audience there of real people that from your scene or something at least. But now there's this whole other force that is the algorithm itself, which is, you know, can create an artist and find real people that really like the music and artist, but they're not from a scene or anything. The algorithm's literally, you know, guiding new people into the music that don't even come from a sub scene or culture.
And so then you can have these show in their life.
Right. Yeah. And then eventually if that gets big enough, you can have a show and then a bunch of people will buy a ticket and show up in a room, but they don't have a shared history. They're not from, you know, it's really bizarre that the algorithms actually are creating new audiences. And then there's some artists that do well in the algorithm that never will ever be able to have they just don't really, you know, it's like there's a shallowness to that, but there's also a depth possible there. But it's still, this is the day when the algorithms are like doing a lot. And so to have a history and a culture and a fan and a scene, like to be part of something and have algorithmic reach, I mean, that's, you guys are just the poster child for that. And it's just incredible because your playlists and the things you get on, you have to convert those people, but you're able to because you already have this whole scene, culture, history, work ethic done, you know. And so when people find you from the algorithm, they can become those core fans like For Today has. But if you just start with a single that goes big on some playlist.
There's like a blueprint for what it is to be for a King fan.
Right.
And exactly. when you're a new band, there's no blueprint. You're just a band I saw on Spotify. There's no personal connection. There's no, like, why should I go to your show?
Yeah. And who will be there if I go? Like, just random strangers that, you know, there's no cult, there's nothing to it. So even if you can sell tickets, it's like you go there and it doesn't feel like anything.
it's just a bunch of other people like, oh, you heard them too on Spotify? Yeah, me too.
Exactly. Yeah. What is that? You know, because there's so much of what we do. It really is that thing. That happens between the band and the crowd. The crowd, they hardcore dance. They dress up. They're participants in the thing that we actually do. The music is written to make them feel and move things in a room. That's what the whole thing is built around, not just computer to earbuds. And so, you know, you guys have just had such success with both that it's just mind-blowing. It's obviously hugely successful. I'm glad you've re-signed to Solid State. But it's like everything is just totally working. How did that, you know, how did that work? When did you feel that? And what were you, were you counting monthly listeners? Like, what is your relationship when you think about the metrics or the computer side of things? How does that, what's that like in your world?
I really look hard at followers to listener counts. I was told by somebody who like specializes in all this stuff. He does work for like Motionless and White, Ice Nine Kills, stuff like that. He's like, you want at minimum a 1-4 follower to listener ratio at minimum. He's like,
1-4. Say that again. I had either my
in like a yours, 1-4 follower to listener ratio.
What's the difference?
So if you have so there's people that actually physically follow your band on Spotify versus a listener, because you could just passively like go jam something because, oh, I was just in the mood to listen to some Blindside today or something like that. But you don't like follow them because they're not putting out actively new music all the time or something like that.
following is almost a way of somebody saying, I want to know everything this band puts out, because it'll send an alert to your phone when new music drops.
Got it. Got it.
So like there's bands that I won't name names. I've seen access to some bands that have like 100,000 monthly listeners because they were a small band that got a playlist. They have 3,000 followers. So it's like, how many repeat customers are you actually going to get whenever, like what happens when you stop getting playlists? You only have 3,000 followers. Whereas a band like Motionless almost has a 1-to-1 follower. Like their fan base is all in on Motionless. Anytime they put out music, they want to know about it. And that's impressive because they have like 2 million monthly, maybe more now. So they have like, same with Ice Nine Kills. Any dedicated fan base, if you look at their like monthly listener to follower count, they're going to be super, like way above that 1-to-4 minimum. Like our band is like 1-to-2.5 right now, which is still great. It's way above that 1-to-4. And I'd imagine if you looked at ABRs, you would, I think this information's even like accessible to everyone on the
desktop. I don't know where you app. See followers. I mean, obviously the monthly listeners is becoming the dominant metric that I think everybody, and I love it. I'm so happy we've arrived at somewhere other than sound scans or whatever.
All right. Now, this has proven my theory. So if you actually click on the bio on the desktop app on Spotify, and it'll tell you the followers and monthly listeners. So ABR 683 1,000, which you're just like, there's bands with way more. Like, but they have 628,000 followers. So almost every single one of those listeners is a person that is like, I want to know everything about ABR anytime they put out music.
I am so glad you pointed that out to me. I didn't realize that association, but that's terrific. Y'all have 300-something thousand to 900-something thousand. So you're 1-to-3 at this time, but you're spiking up in monthly anyway because of the new record and stuff. But
yeah, there's that because we have a playlist. Sometimes playlists will inflate certain things. Because I think we were at around 300,000 when we had 700,000 monthly, right.
Closer to 1-to-2.
So it's gone up 10,000 because of the playlist, and then it'll usually
when you convert settle. Them, you, and then the followers are going to lag. So the playlist is going to lead, them. And then you convert them, and then those followers, a certain percentage of them, you sell tickets to, and that's the whole industry. I mean, it's the whole business model. And then some of them buy VIP and the shirts and the lifetime value, whatever. I mean, turn it into a whole thing. But that's what it is. So, but getting those playlists is the growth engine.
That's where that's why you really got to look at your followers when you get this playlist. Say, are we going up a healthy? We go up since the album rollout around 500 per day, which is
beautiful.
Great for us. And like looking at, so I think if you're trying to look at the size of bands, the better place to look is followers.
So you are on All New Metal, The Core, Adrenaline Workout, Heavy Metal, and Extreme Metal Workout. And those people may not be even have any idea about Solid State Records or have ever been to a hardcore show or anything or a metal, nothing. I mean, they just listen to that, those types of sounds that the computers and algorithms know that you make, and they're just pairing it well. And then since it's good, since it's of substance, since it comes from somewhere real, you convert those people. I mean, it's not shallow, it's deep. I mean, just amazing to have both pedals of the bike, and you guys do it as well as anybody, you know, I'm seeing, and Solid State knows it. You know, Brandon never stops talking about Fit for a King. Every time I see Brandon, he goes, you see Fit for a King? They're this, they're blowing up, they're huge, they're our biggest band. You account for like 14% of his personal ego, I think. it's like because it just works on both levels and everything. Yeah. So it's exciting for Adam, for the label, and for you guys, and just for the scene that's making sense. So I think it's awesome.
Thank you.
What is the way that you know? Tell me more. I'm just tell me more about the way you think then. With the, if you're doing business with computers and the machines now as a broker to the humans, that's kind of, that feels weird, doesn't it?
It does. there's definitely less of a personal connection now than when MySpace was really MySpace was just incredible for music and like personal connection with band members and fans and all that. But now you almost have to play the game. Spotify is like 80% of our streams, and you have to like appease Spotify because you won't play everybody wants playlist because everybody wants that big monthly listener count. And it's almost like just a chase for that number. And that's what's funny about it is that doesn't even mean you make good money. Like good money would come from touring. And so like you want tickets, not you would in a perfect world, you have monthly listeners and tickets. But if you had to choose one, I'd rather have the tickets. So it's definitely tough because you don't want to like, you have to play with the machines. You have to look at the numbers. We build our set list looking at like Apple Music and Spotify streaming trends and just try to like it. It can be useful too because it's very transparent on what your fans like. Mm-hmm.
And you don't think of it as, I mean, because there's editorial playlists and there's people in charge of the playlist too, right? So is that a, are you, you know, are those real connections that you think your manager, the label or somebody has, or their fans that like there's humans involved too? How do you think of that?
So it actually with metal, it used to be there would be a curator. Now there's like a board of 20 people that put together the playlist. So that personal connection, because not one person can alter a playlist like it used to be. And I think it's kind of rough because the new Spotify board is more rock focused. So they don't know a lot about the metal scene. And it's a bummer because you kind of just need someone that knows the metal scene to properly curate a metal playlist. Yeah. And they kind of like they merged, I think it was deathcore and prog instead of having two set. Cause they're like, oh, you can just put them together. And it's like, well, deathcore and prog aren't even close to the same fans. Yeah. Like a BT Bam fan may not like a Whitechapel song or vice versa. And it's just like, it just feels like now there's not as much care for metal and they're just kind of clumping it all together and stuff. So I guess that's kind of a bummer because it used to be just a person you would hit up and now it's just a board for rock music.
Yeah. It was better than the full gatekeeper radio DJ payola the old days or something.
Oh yeah.
Or, you know what I mean? It's more democratized kind of at least. Yeah. Right. Pay to play and everything else. I wonder if people are, you know, I mean, I've been talking about a lot of technical things and vehicles and business and stuff like that, yeah. but you're the key to all this is your music. So let's spend time now talking about the, you know, the creative side of this. What is, I'm about to ask a dumb question, like what's your songwriting process or something, but you know, what things do you recognize and have recognized from other people in the creative process that is also in line with being, you know, I'm studying people that are younger and more advanced and doing well. That's kind of how I think about it. But what do you notice in the innovation or methods of creative work in your band and in, you know, the bands you draw from and are influenced by?
We just see a lot of bands that are taking off. It's all about like, so that you have to have this balance when you're writing now of, because unfortunately music has kind of been boiled down. It went from full length albums were the popular format to singles. Now it's clips of a single that could potentially blow it up. Like look at Feel Nothing from Plot New has almost 130 million streams because TikTok really like took it. And a lot of people probably have only heard the chorus until they go stream the whole song. And it's that one little chorus made that song gigantic. So there's this balancing act of writing now. It's obviously you want it to be genuine and what it representative of what your band is and enjoys, a mixture of what your fans enjoy, and then a mixture of what can you like, you want potential viral moments for the internet because that's such an important thing, and you try to make it an organic viral moment, not forced.
Yeah. And I mean, so you're like, thinking about stuff like that when you're writing with the band, that's on your mind? Viral moment?
There's times where it's like, because I guess it's just viral moments, another way of saying something's really catchy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I do think bands write stuff now thinking this could be a big TikTok. Hopefully this takes off on TikTok. Like, hopefully. And there's times like even our producer will be like, is there a way we could word that to where it could be more like accessible for something like a TikTok? So it's not like compromising the whole song, but it's like maybe this part we could make it this way. So it could be a little more like have more like viral potential. Mm-hmm. And it sucks because that is something people think about, because songs on TikTok go to like number one on rock charts, stuff like that. And it's insane.
And I heard you say that you work really hard. I mean, your vocal style, so, you know, if you just think about it from lyrics, screaming sound, I know you sing too, but and the delivery of that, I heard you say that you work really hard at enunciating, you mm-hmm. know, on all that. And that seems like it is a big part of your what makes you stand out is that. How did you develop that that attitude and posture, like screaming for you? Where does that come from? Who are you trying to emulate all the way back before there was TikTok and stuff like that?
Definitely, I'd say the big three growing up for like screaming, singing inspiration were Spencer Chamberlain was definitely one of them. Jeremy McKinnon was a big one for me. Chester Bennington. Of course,
yeah. Lincoln Park. Who is the middle one? I don't know.
Jeremy McKinnon, Day to Remembers.
Oh, Day to Remember. Okay, that's right. Right.
And then I'd say the fourth one, which is where I got a lot of like deathcore, low scream influence, was Phil Bozeman from Whitechapel. Was a big one. And yeah, what stood out to all of these about all of these vocalists is I could understand most of, if not all, the words they were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Day to Remember is great at that. They're so great at being catchy and intelligible and still totally bringing. And Spencer's very clear. Spencer's, he's a top. He really is a very particular talent at that. Yeah, that's fascinating. Do you guys, what is your songwriting like, though? Do you jam the music in a group, or do you have any traditional songwriting methods?
Unfortunately, when we first started, it was a lot of that, but now it's a lot of computer writing. Because we have a member that lives in New York, one that lives in LA, and then two or three that live in Texas. So, mm-hmm. and one of them's in Houston, while two, me and Bob, are in DFW. So it's kind of like we're all spread out. So we do a lot of our writing in the studio. Well, in the past, the last three records, we'll book like a 6-7 week block, go get like an Airbnb, and just kind of live in LA for a month, just write a lot. We're wanting to change it up a little bit on this next record, where we'll do three-week periods with space in between them. We want the first week to just be us at our guitarist's apartment in LA.
That where it's just good.
Us as a band writing, no producer, no anything, just us writing. Then we'll do 2 weeks with producers. And then we'll sit on all what we did for those 3 weeks for like 2-3 months. Because I think you get a good idea if something's like going to stay. And if you're tired of listening to something by the next time you do your 3 week session, then it's like, that shouldn't be on the record then. Because people are going to need to listen to this forever. So it should never get old. And if you're the one who wrote it and it's already gotten old in 2 months, then it's probably going to have an even shorter shelf life with people that didn't have that connection of writing the song. So I think we're going to do a lot of that for the next record, just so we can get more of that, like, as close to organic band feel as you can without actually jamming in a room. But it's, I like the way we do it because I like having an instrumental and writing to the instrumental. Like, I just love sitting by myself writing lyrics. It's something that I'm not big on, like communal stuff with lyrics. Now, what I do tell people in the band is if you have some really good lyrics, I would love them and they will go on a song. Like, but I want to write around them and stuff like that. So I don't box out anybody on like writing. And then I do present them and say, would you like anything changed? Or so it's definitely not one of those things where I'm writing them, what I write stays, but I like writing alone.
Mm-hmm.
Then, because then I can like write things that end up being stupid and then erase them before anybody ever sees it.
And you like to do that already having the instrumental?
I do, but what I like to do with the instrumental, I don't play an instrument. But I do think I have a really good grasp of like feel and song structure. So there's times I will say like, I know what I want to write the song about. And I'll say this song doesn't feel sad enough, or this doesn't feel angry enough. And we really try to lock in like the song. If it's going to be an angry song, it needs to feel angry before the lyrics are ever put on it.
Mm-hmm. And so you have topics and themes that you're looking for the instrumentals to resonate and then synchronize and then further develop from there.
Yeah. And I'll say things like, really want a big open chorus right here. Or like, this needs to be a little faster tempo. Or this. So I can give input in that way. So I try to help shape it while Bob and Dan and and it's primarily Bob, Dan, and Drew, the producer, will build the instrumental. I will not be in the room. Typically, I'll be within earshot of the room because I want them to have their space. And if something's great, I'll be like, that's it. That's awesome. Like, I love that. Or if something's weird, I'll go in there and be like, are you guys set on this? Because I'm not feeling this. Because I don't play an instrument, so I don't need to sit in there while they're working out technicalities and stuff. They are a fan of me being able to walk in and just be like, this isn't angry enough. This isn't sad enough. Like, because it's like I can hear the final product. Now, like, this chord progression just isn't what I'm feeling. Like, I want to feel, because you know as a musician that you can feel an emotion from the music as you're writing it. So if I'm not feeling the emotion from the music, then I don't think the listener's going to feel it, even if I throw lyrics on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this particularly, the new album, I'm sure you're feeling good that it's, you know, already jamming and people are liking it. It seems like both the humans and the machines both like it. But the content on it is really heavy. And you know, it seems like a heavy content album.
It is. It's as close to like a concept record as we've written.
Do you mind sharing a little bit more about that or you know, the inspiration that is in the themes without me having to guess or be overly suggestive? I don't know if you're talking about them or how you feel about that.
But
it just seems particularly dark and stuff.
I did a full breakdown. If people want to go in like song by song, like deep detail, I did a breakdown with Kerrang on each one.
I'll link it. That's great.
The overall themes of the record, though, there's three levels. So the album's called The Hell We Create. The first level is the hell we create for ourselves with anxiety, with stress. Like, how many times have we been anxious and stressed over something and then it never happens? And it literally consumes our thoughts for days. It affects our sleep. It affects our mood. It like makes every day feel like hell because you're anticipating disaster constantly. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of that during the pandemic, like thinking no one will ever care about our band again. We'll never be able to tour. My career just ended and it's not even at my own hands. It's like, so I think that. And guess what? We're touring again and everything's fine. So it's like I spent probably a year thinking about that and it never happened, which is just looking back. It's crazy. And I'm like, wow, I really created a quote unquote hell for myself thinking there's going to be a world with no music and all this stuff. It was wild. And then the next layer is how our hells can create hells for others. And that's because we adopted two children about 3 years ago. And their parents, the kids were taken due to abuse. And a lot of that had to do with alcohol. Which the hell they had was their parents. Their mom's mom passed away and she wasn't able to really handle it, started drinking, became a lot angrier. Husband started drinking because she was, the wife was, it was just a whole mess where it caused a chain reaction to where both parents started drinking, were a lot angrier, were abusive. Kids eventually got taken away, which then put them into the system for 2 years. They had 17 different homes in a year and a half.
Oh my gosh.
And so it's like the mom's hell was ready at was her mom passing away, which then she started drinking and alcoholism. She lost her job, lost everything, created hell for herself. Well, that hell created one for the kids when they get taken, put into, and it's almost like how trauma's passed down. And so it's like her trauma created trauma for others. And we just really are thinking about the effects our actions can have, because now that I have kids, if I fall apart, it could ruin the kid's life. So I need to find ways to be strong, be a good role model and stuff like that. And then I'd say the third, which is a little bit of like a more societal political take, is politics. We've created a hell for ourselves, particularly in America, where
collectively, yeah.
Yeah, it's just disaster. Everything's disaster. Like if one side does this, it's the end of the world for the other side. And if one side does this, it's the end of the world for the other side. And everything's awful. Everything sucks. The world's going to hell. And it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because everybody says it's going to be bad and then starts living it out. And even goes to like pharmaceutical stuff, because my wife's stroke and all that was caused by birth control. And we found out it was a birth control that's been sued, had class action lawsuits against it and all that. But it continues to be on the market because money. So we let greed and stuff create hell for others, mm-hmm. even if it affects people like my wife and others. So it's a lot of just issues pertaining to those things.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that family stuff, you know, all the way around. It sounds like you have a really dynamic family with a lot going on. But, I am asking directly about spiritual themes. Is that something, how does that fit in general? Or is that, you know, not, how does spiritual themes fit in?
I'd say, cause I have like interesting, my views, I am a Christian, have a relationship with Jesus. My views are very like different than traditional church from travel and just my own reading the Bible, stuff like that. So it's not a big point on this record. There's definitely moments where it's brought up because it's part of my life, but that's mainly about like humans ruining humans' lives and stuff we do to ruin them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think that's fascinating. Just, you know, in the whole landscape of things and Christian and solid state and the imagery and heavy music and, you know, there's so much. The spiritual layer is at least there in the sense that, metal itself and all this dark music and heaviness, and it's tied to Christianity and spiritual and everything, is just a complexity that, even if it's not on the nose, is part of the fabric of the whole culture of metal. You know what I mean? So it's in that way, that part's already there. So it's part of the backdrop, you know, in a sense there, that makes it more complex.
It's like people listen, if you listen to it knowing my like view on Christianity, then it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. Whenever you hear it through that lens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, has that been any, you know, is that been any part of your career, positive or negative, having Christian association, just that generally with this scene, solid state, that part of history, business, all that, what interface has it had? Or it seems like not that prominent.
I'd say a lot of it is stuff I probably don't even know about. Like I've heard of one occasion where that we didn't get an offer because they thought we would preach. So it's like, I don't know how many times that's happened where we just never hear about it. I think it'd be more of that, because obviously I think the bands that do take us on tour don't care, because they offered us a spot on their tour. Mm-hmm. I'd say the worst part or the biggest hurdle with being a Christian artist, like, and I don't even consider ourselves a Christian band, because I think that would be lying, because I think it's not like, we don't treat it like it's like our mission to spread the gospel. And I'm just honest with people about that. I play music because I love playing music. I am a Christian, so that will be in our music, but it's not the sole purpose. I'm not like, so I'd say we are the whole, they're Christians and they're in a band thing is more accurate, as people like to throw around. But I'm like, I don't want to be fake and go like, oh yeah, this is why I do this. God is the only reason. It's like, it is a reason, but it's not the sole reason I'm up here. I like playing music. There's some selfish reasons to why I play, do it too. But the hardest part is honestly dealing with Christians a lot of times, because they want to like project their beliefs onto you because they believe your band should be doing what they would be doing if they were in a band. Like, well, if I was out there, I'd be preaching every night from the stage, and I'd be like, I'm not a very gifted speaker. So it's like, I don't feel like that's something. I was like, I think I speak through our music. And whereas he's like, well, Maddie would do it. And I'm like, Maddie is an incredible speaker. He's a pastor at a church. She's like, that's his calling. It's like, I failed speech in college, and I'm super bummed when we have technical difficulties because I have to talk for 2 minutes. It's like, it's not something that's natural for me. So I think dealing with people that kind of project themselves onto it, because they almost, I think there's this weird sense of entitlement by a very small group of people that they believe like they're entitled to saying like, your band should do this, your band should do that. Like, they're entitled to like directing our band and how we should be operating. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're doing a terrific job of speaking, in that you speak very much plainly and truthfully in the moment of, you know, you tell it, you're very clear. And stuff like that. Yeah, so
I just don't have the enthusiasm like a Maddie where you can get everyone pumped up.
Right. That's a different skill. Yeah. I mean, but communicating what you're thinking thoughtfully, I think you do a quite good job of that. So, and then you're right. You speak through your music and the lyrics and having that time alone to do that. Before we go, let's just go through a couple songs. The big ones so far on this, I know, are The End and Reaper. So tell me just a little bit about, you know, each of those songs, if you don't mind, before we split.
End is about the night my wife was in the hospital. The others! Me kind of describing what was happening. I didn't know if she was going to live or not. They had told me she had a 99% blockage in 5 different arteries in her head.
Oh my gosh.
Including her jugular, which is obviously one of the largest arteries. She couldn't even like speak or move or anything because she was having a stroke. And they were like, we might have to do emergency neurosurgery if this medicine doesn't work, like the blood thinners. Fortunately, they worked. She's still, she's about to have her 3rd surgery, like brain surgery. So this was 2 years ago, and she's still going through a lot of stuff. It's actually this month she has her next brain surgery, because the veins keep collapsing and stuff, and they have to like reprop them open. I feel awful for her, but the song is basically about dealing with the prospects of everything I was dealing with that night. Like, the idea of losing her, the idea of becoming not just a new dad to a teenager and a 10-year-old, but also being a single dad to a teenager and 10-year-old, and like a million thoughts going through my head. And that's why the lyrics, like, I don't think I'll survive the other side, which is like the other side of the situation and stuff like that. Because some people are like, oh, it's about death. Or it's about heaven is the other side. No, it's like the other side of this, like, it's just kind of a visual of like the other side of everything happening.
Wow. That is so hard to imagine how you're able to balance all of those things and be on the road. I mean, how is that even possible?
Well, she's incredible. So that would be the first thing. Like, she's just with the kids being and she's working. she's just grinding, even with all these medical issues. She's seeing like 5 different doctors and then has work and then picks the kids up from school and does all that. And we do, fortunately, like I tell people, like we're in a financial position because our fans are so awesome and our supporters, that we do have like a babysitter on retainer that anytime she needs a break, she can have her come over, have her cook dinner, get the kids, like anything to help. Mm-hmm. While I'm gone.
That's just beyond imagination, you know. That's beyond imagination.
I'll also give credit to my band because they're also incredible, because they like started paying me a little bit extra for the management stuff, which I never got paid extra for. And they're like, you deserve it. You do the management stuff, and we want to help you pay for the babysitter. Wow. Or like the nanny. And they're like, so it will take a little bit of a hit to pay you for that so you can afford the nanny. So they're all awesome.
It sounds like you have a great culture that you have been able to build in your band, embedded in a good culture, and are creating one, hopefully in your household, as well, changing patterns and dynamics there. So, even if it just some of that coming from the parents you had and that, I don't know. That's just, if there's things that are passed down that are trauma, there's also things that are passed up that are good. I mean, that seems part of the story. That's beautiful.
And my dad's one of those. He came from a traumatic household. Dad left him their family when he was 3 years old. He had like 4 or 5 brothers and sisters. Abusive stepdad, stuff like that. And he kind of just ended the cycle. Yeah. And that's why it's so big. Like, he joined the military so he could go to college, went to college, got his diploma or his degree. And he kind of ended that cycle by saying, I'm not going to let my kids struggle like I struggled.
Wow. I mean, there's certain saints out there, angels or something, who are able to just know. I mean, I guess it just is like noticing the cycle to break it as it's a really a compound good when people are able to have that clarity to do so. That's beautiful.
It is. And I guess, that song was, so End all the way through Reaper kind of connect on the album. It's like the gradual like progression of things during the pandemic. So Reaper End is about that night. And then Reaper is the last song. And it's about just my first brush with potential death and realizing death comes for us all. It doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are, how healthy you are, at any moment. So you just need to, I know it's generic to say live every day like it's your last, but you just need to be a loving, caring person and be ready to leave the legacy you would want left behind, because you don't know when your time's up. So you need to make sure every moment counts and you're doing good for other people and yourself.
Wow.
Because you can't put it on the back burner because you don't know if it'll be there.
Right. So all this just, it's got to be the case that after the pandemic, after the things that you've gone through, with the experiences you're having and being out on the road with this material, singing, I mean, I can't imagine what you're able to tap into and are feeling or experiencing on stage with this now. Like, that just must, these shows must, at the size they are and the opportunity you have, and I just cannot imagine what those moments are like for you on stage right now. They must be something else.
They are. And I think it's going to hit even harder when we do like headline stuff. Right. Cause still, yeah, like for sure, for supporting, there's still a lot of people that are just blank staring. Uh-huh. But I'm like, when we do the headliner, it's going to hit hard with people actually singing along and piling.
But
up.
Are you getting there in your head? I totally understand that situation.
Oh, I'm getting there in my head.
That you're catching these lyrics, doing these songs.
Yeah.
In person and with, you're at least getting there in your performance. And then when the headliner's there, they'll be receiving them with an open channel, having read your breakdown of these songs or having heard interviews like this or whatever. And they're going to know what you're talking about. And you're going to be, that's the stuff that that's the type of experience that people cannot even imagine, I think. That's incredible to have. I just, it, that's yeah, just right the now, most magic.
on, I'd say it's a lot for me on stage, like therapy with singing these songs. And when the headliner comes, it's like we can all join together.
Oh my gosh, that is going to be wild. Some of those lyrics and lyric breaks and well enunciated, them knowing the lyrics and participating, and you hearing that stuff you've been through, worked on, reflected back to you in that moment of collective. That stuff is just, that's just what it's all about.
That,
I mean,
that is literally, that's one of my favorite things about music in general, just hearing people sing these words that mean so much to you, and it means something to them too.
Wow. So fascinating, because it can be so shallow. Like, it can just be pop stuff and machines and algorithms and nothing that's meaningless. Yeah. And it can be as deep as those experiences, you know, are and will be. So, so fascinating. Ryan, this has been an incredible conversation. I mean, I've really learned a lot.
Thank you.
I don't have anything else, but, you know, I hope you guys have a great show tonight. Glad y'all are safe. And congratulations on all the success you've had, and the new record is terrific, and people are digging it. So people and machines.
Yeah. Hopefully, I can't wait until we get to play these on a headliner and have people sing along with us. We got about, the record will be out for about 5 months. So plenty of time to practice for everyone, get their singing voices good.
That's great. It's not, you don't have anything announced on that other than you're planning it. Right.
Yeah, we can't announce it till after this tour is over.
Yeah, when this tour is over, you're going to announce it and who's on it and all the details
about
are coming.
A week after this tour ends, we'll announce the headliner.
That's going to be exciting. Well, stay tuned for that announcement. But have a great show, and you know, talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Labeled. My name is Marshall, and a favorite song of mine is "The Boy Who Stopped the World" by Aaron Sprinkle. Because I think it's the first song I learned on acoustic guitar. Labeled is produced by Matt Carter and Knucklebreaker Productions at Compound 3 Recordings. Editing and sound design by Seth Thompson. Editorial oversight by Jim Worthen and Adam Scatula. Brand and design direction by Joel Buchelman. Our production manager is Katie Franson. Executive producers are Brandon Ebel and Matt Carter. Additional support from Marshall Firmith, Tyson Paoletti, and Anna Mirtzaglocki.
Right now you're sick and tired, you're feeling sad, you're feeling uninspired, and the clock just won't slow down like it gets its kicks, pushing you around, you around. Maybe in the morning it won't be quite as bad as it seems, but the fact that you can't change the speed of sound, the rate of age, is an understatement to the state of mind you're not used to, used to. Feeling sad, feeling uninspired. So I pray for you, my friend, that you'll fall down, you'll give in. You'll give in.